Hi. I'm going to be really interactive, and that's because I finished the slides at around 1:30 a.m. and got up to fly here at 4:30 a.m. Running on caffeine here. You guessed this much, I hope. Otherwise, wrong room, down the hall to the left. I'm here to talk about games. I spend an awful lot of time talking about games. Do any of you spend a lot of time talking about games? Some of you. Not a lot of you. Of course, the chap with the green hair. Naturally enough. The commonest thing about games that people say is that they are frivolous. Have any of you ever said that? Frivolous. Adjective. Unworthy of serious attention. Inappropriately silly. Which to me conjures up, you know, Monty Python walks or something. But even worse is the derivation. From Latin, frivolous, of little value, to crumble. Well, people are nuts. Games are not frivolous. Games are arguably a more important driver of human culture than all the work you do here, no offense. It could be even argued that they're more important than literature, than music, than the high arts. After all, we don't necessarily, despite some recent businesses that have made a mint, don't necessarily come out of the womb appreciating Mozart. We don't really come out ready for James Joyce. You know, it takes a little while. And yet, we do come out of the womb into games. So, lesson number one that I want to convey here, which I realize is propagandistic, but it's a propaganda that I convey frequently, is that games are not pointless. They're not for kids anymore, although kids are really into them, nor are they, in particular, inappropriately silly. That is because games are actually sent to us by the development of human nature to eat our brains. They are, yes, they eat them and they regurgitate them in new shapes. They're not really here to turn us into zombies, quite the opposite, actually. They're kind of like the virus that makes our brains better. They're here in order to reshape us. Games are actually one of the fundamental learning tools that humans, and in fact most animals, employ, particularly at early ages. Of course, today, games are kind of spreading around, aren't they? I mean, they're everywhere now. A lot of you probably have them on devices that you carry in your pockets. You may not want them there, but they're there. I'm here to warn you about this. You know, it's kind of a heads up. It's not really a really danger-filled warning. It's not to tell you, watch out, games are here to eat your brains and leave you zombies. I'm actually on the opposite side of that particular debate. But it is a warning that a different world is mostly here. It's colliding with reality as we know it. And things are changing pretty quick because of games. So I'm here to warn you about that world that's coming. Because it's too late for me. Games got me already. I started playing, you know, ordinary kinds of games, the kinds most people are familiar with, the everything from tic-tac-toe and snakes and ladders and all of those kinds of things when I was very, very little. I doubt any of you remember the exact age at which you played those. But I started playing the new generation of games. What, if you ask a 16-year-old, game actually means, which is video games, when I was about 7. And I was really part of the first generation to grow up with games as a major force in cultural media from early childhood. For me, it was actually a Sears Magnavox Pong machine that you hooked up with little RF connectors up to your TV, probably the spare black and white one, because, you know, back then you didn't have spare color TVs. There was one, and it stayed in the den. And, you know, we played Pong, and then a little bit later I got an 8-bit computer run by the massively powerful 6502 chip. And I played a lot of games, and I learned to program. And I was programming by the time I was 10. Today, I'm a slow learner. Today, My kids started out working with really wonderful 32 to 64-bit processors in high-definition television, playing games, and also playing with ones that they could carry around in their pocket, with more memory stuffed in their pocket, of course, than fit on my entire storage system on my Atari 8-bit. And they started when they were 3. Any of you parents whom that freaks out? It freaked me out. But it's almost like the air we breathe. There was no way to get away from it. So, you know, one of the first comments made was, oh, how nice it is to see a Park Forum speaker with some gray in their hair. I'm only 34. but I'm kind of in the vanguard of something here. And it really is a cultural shift. Because let me tell you, for the kids today, this is like radio was. It's just ubiquitous, and it's a commodity. It's way too late for me. Let me tell you how you might guard yourselves against this coming scary world. Where did games come from? I'm going to talk about a couple of different broad kinds of game, okay? We all grow up playing little simple games, right? I mean, in your childhood, you play tag, right? You should all be nodding. I mean, come on. Cops and Robbers, Tea Party, yes, you all played games. You also probably all played Monopoly, chess. If you came from an adventurous family, Go. Yeah. So, lastly, of course, this one down here is what my kids think games are. And that is, you know, a little side project that Willie Higginbotham worked on, you know, a little while after finishing up with the Manhattan Project, where he decided to get his oscilloscope to, you know, do some different stuff. And he accidentally invented video games and spent much of the rest of his career regretting it because he really wanted people to interview him about nuclear nonproliferation instead. The world of boards is one world that games come from. Board games have been played for thousands of years. We can pull out dice sets from Roman ruins. We can pull out what look awfully like kind of prototypical chess pieces, maybe, but we're not sure. Possibly only played on a 2x2 board, and I don't understand how that works. From Babylonian ruins. You know, there are some really, really old board games out there. This is a very, very old pastime. We can see the games come from the regular world. I assume most of the guys in here probably grew up kicking a ball at some point with an objective. You know, rules. Put it through that opening over there or over that particular thing or through that window or, you know, something like that. And then lastly, there's the new kind of modeling of games in new kinds of spaces. What is a game is what this begs the question, because those are radically different. I mean, how can we put Tetris, Go, and soccer all in one box and say, yeah? And yet we do instinctively, right? I mean, in every language I've ever looked at, these are all considered to be very similar. We've got some interesting words to kind of clarify. We say, well, that's a sport, and that's play. And that, you know, and the problem is you go to the dictionaries, and forgive my language, the dictionaries suck. They can't tell these words apart. I challenge you, go look at a dictionary and try to follow the thread from game to play to fun to sport and then out to hobby and come back, and you will be so much more confused than you were when you started that will really kind of open your eyes that games are very ill-defined. So I want to take a step back, a grounding in the familiar. Because my background is actually in liberal arts. I'm no scientist. I don't know why the hell you have me here. My background's actually in this stuff. When was the last time you had a Master of Fine Arts person giving a park form? It might have been a while. So this is my background. This is what I'm familiar with. Actually, most of us are familiar with this stuff. Art is a medium, right? What does that mean? What is a medium? It's a channeling of information into a particular form so that it can be transmitted, right? That's really what it's about. And really, the shape it takes is really what we stick a label on, right? If it's visual, we call it art. If it's, you know, auditory, we call it music. If it's written down with little scratchings or symbology on the surface, we call it writing. And often they kind of shade one into the other, right? What's more, there's a whole bunch of media that are kind of composite, where you have something like, oh, comics, which are a combination of two of these, or movies, which are a combination of all of these, and where the media just kind of stack one on top of the other, and we make use of all of the different transmissible elements there in order to convey a message. It's been argued that games are the medium of the 21st century. And in some ways, games are a medium. They can encode information, and they can transmit it. But there's a really fundamental way in which they aren't the kind of media that we're used to. The usual answer here is, that's because they're interactive. That answer is bull. All media are interactive. You have to decode this stuff. You have to interact with it to understand it. We have to learn to read. It's not like it just happens. We even have to learn to listen to music, because hearing music and listening to it are very different things. And understanding what is conveyed by Copeland versus Eminem, you know, you got to pay attention. The thing that's different about games is that they are models, as opposed to just being media. Now, the thing about models is that you can poke and prod them, that's true. They do provide interactivity. The other interesting thing about models is that they're not fixed. There's something you can pick up and look at from another side. And yes, obviously, generations of literature students in particular have learned how to pick up books and look at them from other sides. Often, you know, crypto-Marxist deconstructionist ones. But nonetheless, fundamentally, most media offer a certain kind of linearity to them, right? You're walking through them in an order. The content they provide is fixed. They provide a highly constrained possibility space to explore merely by the nature of what they're presenting, right? In order to illuminate new views on them, we have to gloss them sometimes. We have to juxtapose them. We have to say, well, yes, Eminem is much more interesting when you consider him juxtaposed to Copeland. Do y'all know who Eminem is? Just checking. So all of a sudden, those different things start looking similar when we think of games being models, okay? Because what we're really looking at when we're looking at games is these highly artificial, highly abstracted tinker toy versions of reality, okay? The board game model says, and thank you for having the appropriate carpet installed. The board game model says, you know what? The world can be quantized into discrete spaces. How convenient. It says, you know what? Unlike the messy world where wind might blow in different angles, it always moves only on diagonals. Very convenient for modeling. It says, you know what? Synchronicity doesn't exist. I move this much. You move that much. And we'll take turns, and eventually our hands will collide. Very convenient for modeling. All of you who work with computers know this, because computers have to do this in order to function. The sports model, very similar, only it says, you know what, never mind this whole quantizing junk. I mean, forget that part. We can actually, if you're a programmer, you'll appreciate this. We can actually import .h, reality, physics, and give us this back. Hooray, I can move freely. And instead, we're only going to put certain rules on, such as, yes, I can move freely, but reality ends at the white line over there, and the white line over there, and that one, and there's a special kind of wormhole at that end, and another wormhole at this end, and we have to move my particle through that wormhole, right? And all of a sudden, we get soccer. So it's still a model. It just happens to import a whole bunch of convenient predefined rules that life gives us in order to work with. And then there's the tea party, freeform play. How many of you have played a tea party with a little girl recently. Good. You people will appreciate what I'm saying. There are a hell of a lot of rules to tea parties. Physics is simple compared to tea parties. Oh no, you can't pick up that cup. And that doll isn't talking to that teddy bear. We tend to think of play as being free form. It's very, it's the artsy side. It's you know, the child psychologists are all like, well, there's games, and that's very, you know, you got to be goal-oriented and get things done. And then there's play. Play has way more rules than games do. One of the rules is you have to figure out your goal all the time. It's actually a really complicated rule. Play is usually, instead of importing simple rule sets like physics, is importing complicated rule sets like who likes who and under what circumstances. And as we all know, that can be a very bewildering game. Very difficult to understand things like social relationships. Like when mommy and daddy go up to that room in order to argue, what does that mean? Which is a very common scenario playing house. Well, games are all models. They're just of varying complexity. Then we have the video game model. The video game model actually has a lot in common with the board game model. That is because video games run on computers, and computers quantize everything. So video games tend to be very tightly bounded. But these days, they're actually starting to get a clue from things like sports and play. We're starting to see, well, models of physics being imported so that we can pretend that we're playing soccer, although really we're playing a video game that only remotely models soccer, right? But it's plausible enough. We're starting to import rule sets from outside. We're starting to do video games where you have to play house. And that one actually imports very well, because once you have live chat, mommy and daddy can argue for real. This is the version of games that's eating the world. Board games, once upon a time, sorry, Milton Bradley, not anymore. Once upon a time, they were as important to our lives as television. A night a week, got together from Monopoly. Monopoly moved a truly ridiculous amount of copies. Trivial Pursuit has sold something like 35 million boxes. How many of you go to board game nights? Geeks. Now, of course, anything that is this rich and interesting must attract academic attention, which will then attempt to make it as dry and uninteresting as possible. So let me introduce you to one of the commonest ludological theoretical terms. Why are you laughing? That's straight. That's what it's called. Okay, ludology. Picture a magic circle. Of course, I messed you up because earlier I described it as a box bounded by white lines. So pretend for me now that instead it's a circle bounded by a black line. This is the boundary of the game. The interesting thing about games as models is that they end up saying that nothing outside the circle exists. When you, sir, bring in something from outside the circle, he gets mad and calls you a cheater. That's the boundary of the magic circle. Bringing in an element, adding a rule that is not contained within the formal rule set of the game, such as slipping an extra ace out from under the sleeve, right? Or weighting the dice, or, you know, tripping somebody as they're rushing to put the ball in the goal area. The magic circle is this really, even though it's at the edge, it's at the heart of games. It's really the thing that makes games work. No magic circle, no game. More specifically, no magic circle, no fun. And that is because everything inside the magic circle only matters inside the circle. And everything outside the circle should not matter to the game. Hence we get words like sportsmanship and fair play. What?
Ice hockey, yeah. Ice hockey actually has fights as part of the rules these days, I think. I was at a game not that long ago, and I think they do it all. It's part of the point at this now. And everything that happens out here has to be inconsequential to the outcome of the game, as best we can make it. Consider, for example, doping in athletics. We look at doping in athletics through the lens of the magic circle, and it's very easy to conclude that training is part of the game, because otherwise we wouldn't be upset. The game of the race doesn't start when we shoot off the gun. It starts months prior when that person started training. And part of the rules of the game is, well, you're not going to use any additional substances that can be detected. And you know, that's part of the game. So the magic circle is what makes things fun. Because as soon as you don't have the magic circle and stuff within the game starts to matter to the real world, then you get things like, I lost $10,000 in Vegas last week. And that matters, right? And it's no fun anymore. Losing $10,000 in Monopoly money? Woohoo! That can be a lot of fun. Magic circle, really important. Rules you can think of as laws of physics. They are immutable reality. Now, in some games, it's immutable reality that people break, and then you punish them by kicking them out of the circle. Right? No, you're not allowed to do that. Red card. Out you go. No, you're not allowed to do that. Into the penalty box. Out you go. No, you're not allowed to do that. I'm kicking over the chess table now. That kind of thing. These are the immutable laws of reality. In chess, the act of reaching in and picking up a piece and moving it over some squares is outside the circle and is irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you get a robot to do it for you. It doesn't matter if you blow on the piece just to get it to slide over to the next square. It doesn't matter. In the laws of physics of chess, pieces move in these discrete squares. It doesn't matter if you stop partway into a square because that spot doesn't exist. It's quantized out, right? There's no variability. So game space is not space as we think of it. It's actually models of really odd topologies, mathematical spaces that we don't usually deal with. You're all familiar with checkers? Yes? What is the world of checkers? 8x8. No. Have you not played checkers before? It's a diagonal grid in 4x4. The alternate squares do not exist in checkers. Right? Yes? Just checking with you 8x8 people. You might be playing some other checkers I don't know about. This is kind of an odd topology if you think about it. Try wrapping your head around chess. Chess ain't happening on a grid, people. Chess is happening in some weird non-Euclidean mess. We have teleporting pieces in chess. Okay? It's not straightforward. Video gamers. First of all, what is this shape? A torus. Can any of you video gamers here name me a game that happens on a torus? Think further old school than that.
Space War. Asteroids.
Space War. Asteroids. Yes. Technically, I think Pac-Man happens on a Mobius strip. It didn't have gates on the top and bottom, did it? Sometimes. Sometimes it was a Klein bottle. Yay! No. We're up to a tough one now. Those of you who were present at my GDC lecture are not allowed to reply to this. Chutes and ladders. This is a game we teach to four-year-olds. Do you normally discuss wormhole physics with four-year-olds? And yet, look at this topology. This is complicated math. Really? Actually, we don't usually teach this in high school.
because there's no good use for it. Another thing that games tend to teach that actually isn't something that is really conveyed in other media is algorithmic thinking. Games are models. That means they have these results. You grab a node and you pull and you twist and it reconfigures and ka-chunk, it's a new shape. And if it starts in the same state, you can do it again. It's usually something you can replicate. And often you can iterate on it, which, you know, I mean, well, I've spent a lot of time trying to iterate on T.S. Eliot, but it doesn't really get me anywhere. You know, with a game, you can iterate on it, and it will get you somewhere. It's a model. It'll reconfigure into these weird shapes, often something the designers really didn't intend or foresee. Games push you into algorithmic thinking, which is really kind of interesting that at this particular time in our history, a medium that encourages algorithmic thinking is kind of rising to the forefront and replacing media that encourage other forms of thinking. Because the world has gotten a lot more algorithmic all around me. I don't mean the politician. Another interesting thing that games teach in a very interesting way is causality. I kick the ball, it moves this way, because of these particular influences. I learn gravity, I learn force, there's causality. I do this, the ball does that. Very straightforward. I rotate my Tetris piece, and it behaves in this way. In fact, to be honest, games frequently lie to us about causality because they're way too predictable. They build these toy models that give us these scenarios that seem to claim that when you poke somebody this way, they will always react the same way. And it's just not true. Games are, however, starting to get a little bit better at this. Now, other media kind of try to teach causality. You know, I mean, Russian novels are big on the causality of make one small mistake and you're going to end up run over by a train or something. And so, you know, there are attempts at teaching causality, but games teach them in really interesting ways, right? They let you actually poke and prod and say, what happens if I derail the train? Yay, Anna gets to live until she meets, you know, the next Russian author. Now, digging a little deeper into this, I mentioned before all games are turn-based. They really all are. Even sports are really turn-based. Sometimes it's really obvious, like tennis is real-time, but not really, right? The game of tennis is estimate the angle and velocity of the incoming projectile, position yourself correctly, apply the correct force and vector to the projectile in order to place it at a particular location that you have determined to be difficult to reach by the opponent. Then they get to do that. And then you get to do it again. You're taking turns. Now, of course, what's happening really on some kind of special quantum level is, you know, real time, at least as fast as our eyes can detect at, you know, 60 odd hertz or whatever our perception rate is, and as fast as the ball can move, because there's really a kind of a maximum of force that a human arm can impute to the ball. But you can time slice all this stuff, and games do, particularly video games, because they're running at a frame rate and they're updating their model, right? One of the interesting conventions of games is this alternating taking turns, which is interesting because it's also bull. There's another way that games condition us to look at the world that is a lie. Games do lie to us a lot. I think I said that already. Tennis is a great example of a symmetric game. What you do and what I do are the same. We are, in effect, both playing the same game. Most classic board games are like this, but not Fox and Geese. Fox and Geese is an asymmetric game. One guy has one fox, the other person has multiple geese. You guys know that one? It's kind of old-fashioned. People don't tend to play Fox and Geese anymore. You can play it with a checkerboard on a 4x4 diamond grid, not 8x8. Most video games, however, are not. They are asymmetric. You're the one little guy, and there's a whole bunch of really giant, ugly aliens from planet Half-Life 2. Galaxian is asymmetric. Asteroids is asymmetric. The computer is not playing the same game that you are. Your objective is, and this will sound familiar, to position yourself correctly in order to intercept a particular vector of force or avoid it, depending on whether it's a power-up or a laser bolt, and position yourself in order to angle a projectile moving across a playfield at a particular velocity to intercept or avoid the thing on the other side. Kind of like tennis. You're going to find a lot of games work out to be kind of like tennis. But the other side is playing this whole other game, which is kill you. Asymmetric game. Kind of an interesting thing that computers have really allowed because it didn't flourish in the other forms. Particularly in board games, it didn't flourish very much. So here's this weird thing. These games, that they have these characteristics. They're algorithmic. They teach causality. They force you to interpret the world as quantized models. Where the hell did this come from? Why are they there? You have to look back at their objective. Why do games exist? To scratch your brain. I was about to say that would hurt, except that it probably wouldn't, because I don't think we waste nerve endings in there. Would you say we play games for fun? Any of you play them for other reasons, like cash? Games, fun. A lot of people say it isn't just about learning. I happen to disagree. I think games are about learning. Do you want to ask questions now or save them? Oh, they're all rhetorical.
I have two.
So, academics have dug into this question of what is fun. Naturally enough, they dug deep into the Greek and Latin and pulled out wonderful words like ludus, paideia, eidlinx, vertigo, aleia, and mimicry, which roughly mean full of rules, more playful. That one means chance-based. That one means tends to affect our inner ear. That one means tends to relate to modeling something in the real world, and I've gone blank on the last one, but it doesn't matter. By and large, as you might guess, I tend to think that this wonderful list on which much of the field of ludology is based is bunk. Right? It's just too complicated an answer. In almost every language, fun keeps getting applied fairly broadly to a wide range of activities that don't seem to have that much in common. And that, to me, based on how languages develop, indicates that they do, in fact, share a common root. And there it is, which the gentleman in the front row spoiled for you. Fun is really about learning. When you look at what young animals do, they play in order to train themselves to perform tasks that later on continue the species, such as batting around mice and then biting their heads off and then leaving them on your pillow. From very, very early on, just about all mammalian species engage in play. And it's a form of training. We watch kittens pretend to hunt. We watch kids practice things. When they're playing house, they're feeling out the dimensions of human society, which sounds really lofty. When they scribble on your wall in crayon, try to remember that, that it was in a good cause. They're creating future society. Fun is really about learning. Fun is really literally an endorphin dump, just like, you know, chocolate and orgasm give you, that is given to you on this moment of mastering patterns that you find around you in the world. Now, are there any cognitive scientists in the room? Okay, pretend you're not listening, because I'm about to really, really butcher cognitive science. Do you, sir, see me? No. Your brain is lying to you. In most particular, the stuff your eyes are feeding to your brain doesn't really much resemble me. Can you find your blind spot? Yes? It's somewhere over here. Or, well, yours is somewhere over there. Hold a grid in front of your eyes, and you will find the grid filled in your blind spot. And yet, you have no photoreceptors in that part of your eye. Your brain is lying to you. What's more, I don't actually know who's sitting here. But my brain is filling something in. My eyes have horrible resolution over there. This is that whole frog's eye, frog's brain thing. You can look up the paper. He knows what I'm talking about. Your brain lies to you about stuff all the time. It fills in things that you think you know. It skips over things. You know, have you heard the one about please count all the balls flying by on the screen? And everybody diligently counts all the balls, and then afterwards they say, when did the pink gorilla come in? And you go, what pink gorilla? I was counting the balls like you told me to. And they go, let me replay the video. The dancing pink gorilla that waved at you, that one. Your brain hit him. He was like, I'm counting balls. The gorilla, you know, I didn't even see it. Of course, the brain also notices all kinds of things. Like there's somebody over there in a purple shirt. Yes. Yay. That could have gone really poorly. We've all seen exercises in memory recall. The brain is actually capturing all kinds of information that we don't know we have. You know, frankly, you know, we don't understand all that much about how the brain works. But the one thing we know for sure is that it doesn't work the way we tend to behave like it does. Most of you aren't even really here right now because your brains are off doing other stuff. Unless I'm really engaging, in which case you're intensely focused. Now, it's constantly hairing off after other stuff, building patterns in places that are weird. Let me tell you an old joke. There's a burning building. Flames roaring. It's bad. Fire trucks gathered below. The crowd's going, very scary. And up on the very top is a woman going, oh my God, save my baby, my baby. You know. And down below, the firemen are running around. Gotta catch the baby. Gotta catch the baby. What are we gonna do? And then comes, well, I'm a star football player from the NFL. I can catch the baby. The woman goes, ah! He comes in. Wah! And the crowd goes wild! Why did he do that? Habit, right? We laugh because it's true. Which pants leg did you put on first this morning?
No.
You're sure? Can you take me through the exact process of the order there? How did you put on your pants?
As usual, over my head.
No underwear? You know, we build up these patterns. We live most of our lives really not here, not conscious. We do all kinds of stuff that we're not paying any attention to. These things go by many names, and here's where the cognitive scientist winces again. You know, we call them chunks, we call them schemata, we call them routines. You know, there's a whole bunch of gobbledygook terminology. I usually just say chunk because it sounds good, chunk. We build up chunks. Our brain is building models. Models that often look a lot like games. Oh, it all clicks together here. That's why the kitten is playing. He's building this model so he can build up a habit so he can go on and run his life by paying as little attention as possible. Much of the process of growing up, particularly in early childhood, is about building enough habits so you can successfully sleepwalk through life. So that you don't have to pay attention to keeping your balance, for example. Yeah, it's all about building up your little patterns, right? Your pattern library. And you hope not to be the football player who then misapplies a pattern. And you want to build up a good library of patterns because, you know, playing these games is the way in which you learn that, yes, you like the grape juice, but the blue fluid is Drano. You know, it's a survival skill. You're building up patterns in order to successfully navigate a world that is, frankly, too full of information for us to really cope with. So what you're trying to do is build up this pattern so you can get through life. If games are the way we do this, what does that say about us? Here's where the grim reason for those droopy, blood-stained letters comes apparent.
Oh, heavens. The games that we like to play are about
exterminating things, estimating exactly the velocity at which you toss a rock in order to brain something furry, projecting force along a vector so that we know exactly how far through the critter the spear will go, assessing the arc of a fall, which is pretty complicated calculus, actually, timing actions, because after all, we want the buffalo to run past us, not through us. Collecting, because got to gather those berries. That's dinner. Exploring. Got all these berries. Now what? Building. It started to rain. I don't like being cold. Forming tribes. Aha. I can get him to build a shelter, so I won't be cold. Maybe he can deal with the buffalo, too. In general, it is a seeking of understanding, but it's kind of a crude kind of understanding, okay? It's a very kind of low-level primate kind of understanding much of the time. Now, there are games about much nobler and loftier things. They are out there. It's hard to tell from the video game bestseller lists, but it's true. They do exist. We need to understand why it is that when we look at the television and see the latest video game ads, they horrify us. And the reason is we like to pretend that this stuff doesn't matter anymore. And really, in civilized society, a lot of it doesn't. Although, you know, still got to aim that remote. A lot of these are still relevant. They've just shifted, right? They've just moved into slightly different arenas. The interesting thing is, and I'm one, you now see around you a couple of generations of kids who have grown up taught this way, taught with models, and not just taught out of McGuffey's Reader and with arithmetic and whatnot, the three R's that aren't. What do you think seeing the world as a gamer means? Because, you know, our brains are pretty malleable. You start training us one way, we'll kind of get stuck in a rut. Brains are lazy. Brains are trying to optimize existence, right? They're going to build up these patterns, and they don't want to change them. I think we're going to see that gamers tend to be fairly goal-oriented people. They're going to be people who say, what's the objective? How do I optimize the path through this model? And in fact, there's business books out there these days that make for fascinating reading about how best to use the gamer in your corporate organization. The book is called Got Game, by the way, if anybody wants to look for it. They will be people who quantify, build models. They will prefer simulation to explication. From a business sense, that might be a bad thing because they might think they have multiple lives. Believe it or not, they're going to be heavily driven by collaboration. Many of you may have the image of the game player as the lonely chess genius who sits in a garret studying the collected works of Garry Kasparov and daydreaming of someday beating Bobby Fischer. And that is not what it is at all. Today's gamer is one of a group of kids of mixed gender sitting on a couch, laughing with and at each other, solving a game together. It's a bunch of young girls playing The Sims and communicating their hopes and fears for their little digital people via IM and trading tips and tricks, such as how to get unlimited cash. It is tens of thousands of gamers hanging out on web forums, trading the best method to get power-ups off the prostitutes in Grand Theft Auto. The Grand Theft Auto walkthrough is 1,433K of plain text, 900 printed out pages, 30% longer than the last Tom Wolfe novel. That is a work of collaborative criticism. a non-trivial work. Can't really underestimate what these gamer people will come up with. So, here's the thing. Is this, in fact, eating the world, as I loftily claimed? Yes. It's eating popular culture. How many of you are gamers? Good. 100% of children aged 6 to 10 are gamers. 100%. The kid who isn't a gamer, get him into therapy. He's out of step with his peer group. In the UK, anybody care to hazard a guess at the 50-ish age bracket? How many are gamers? 57. 57%. If you think this hasn't taken over the world already, you're out of step. Check out your peer group. Of course, this is also relevant in other ways. The industry likes to claim it's as big as the movies. It's not. Yet. That's a lot of money for 1 year. This is not a trivial medium. It's certainly big enough for us to worry about what are the messages it is conveying to our children. It's certainly big enough to worry about what the latest opportunist politician is going to say about them. The latest is to classify games as pornography. I believe that one's Wisconsin. Just came out 2 days ago. Utah? There. Of course, there's the pop culture impact. Anybody seen Run Lola Run? Yeah. That's a video game. Anybody seen Groundhog Day?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a video game too. Anybody listen to Beck? Anybody in the room under 30 listen to Beck? Yeah. Well, actually, Summer Girl, what's the riff on that played on? Sounds to me like a Commodore SID chip. Well, so this is a landscape. Where is it going? Are they eating our brains or not? Two kinds of video games today, okay? One of them is what the AAA ones you see advertised on TV are. They're basically really, really, really expensive, subpar, wannabe Pixar things with occasional shoot the alien stuff mixed in. They cost a fortune to make. Sometimes they hit and they earn back a fortune. But just like movies, 90% of them don't break even. This is the mainstream video game industry. Then there's the stuff that you probably have once or twice mailed to your aunt and said, oh, check this out. You like take a baseball bat and whack a penguin. And these are like purer kinds of games. And really, those big expensive ones are built out of a little bit of CGI followed by whack a penguin, followed by some more dramatic CGI and then whacking another penguin, right? That's really how the games work. The games are the models. The stories are irrelevant. In fact, if you're bored by whacking the penguin, there's a really wonderful alternate version now where you can play an anime girl who knocks over one of those Bishunin guys and sends him flying, and your goal is how many classmates to knock over. Same game. You can Google it, but very different art presentation. Perfect for the otaku. Some people say that those expensive CGI extravaganzas are taking us to the holodeck. That where we are headed is to use games as a new form of narrative media, as a way to present scenarios and stories that make use of the techniques of traditional storytelling, of film, of novels, probably not of poetry because nobody reads poetry anymore, but, you know, as much of that kind of stuff as we can. The academics who believe on this side get called narratologists. A lot of people are daydreaming about the holodeck. The other side is what I call the models model. These are the people who think, no, what games are really heading for is ever-increasing simulation, more complex modeling, bigger tinker toys, more things to poke and prod at. If you've ever played any Will Wright games such as SimCity and The Sims and SimEarth and so on, you know this path, right? This is like Tetris taken to the nth degree. The answer isn't going to be, you know, one or the other, obviously. Now, the thing is, you can put holodecks inside of models. You can put models inside of holodecks. The outermost shell always has to be a model. It always has to be a computer simulation. So in the end, they're all going to be models, really. And that's why I say that's really what games are. Games aren't stories. All of those legislators are missing the boat because they keep thinking that they're stories, and they're trying to legislate them as stories with content that they don't like. And they're missing the point. The interesting question is, what happens when we build a really big model? Because the neat thing about models is they don't have to be limited to whacking penguins. They don't have to be limited to chessboards and chess pieces. You can start incorporating instant messaging into your model. Classrooms, lecture halls, cooking TV shows, movies, all kinds of stuff. That is what people tend to call the metaverse. You know, when Bill Gibson said cyberspace, we misappropriated the word and we stuck it on to mean the web. And later on, Neal Stephenson says metaverse, and we all think it means a 3D web. It's a really big dream, right? Any of you guys invested in this dream? Wow, this is so clearly not the 60s anymore. It's a big dream. There are a lot of people out there chasing this. And there are a lot of people who think, you know, this maybe might like really affect how we do business, how we work with each other, how we live and love, and how we order our groceries, and how we shop, and how we teach each other. And you know what? The metaverse is a really giant, hyper-extended game of Quake. It's a game. It's a toy model. We might not be playing it entirely for fun anymore, but it's going to have in its DNA those quantifications, those kind of turn-based kind of things, those notions that the world can be reduced into these patterns. So, are games going to eat the world? If there is a metaverse, it'll be one of those composite media. It'll be a game that starts bringing in and swallowing up all these other media. It'll be one where you can log in, write your term paper, and in the virtual world, watch a TV show while chatting with your friends. And the DRM isn't going to work because the server will be distributed across multiple continents anyway, and nobody will know what the jurisdiction is. It is easier to imagine every other medium inside games than it is to imagine games inside any other medium. This, we can see it happening. There's even a consortium forming, meeting in 2 months to try to determine the protocol for this. Scary thought. On one hand, you go, you know, that could be kind of fun. The whole world is a game. And that's kind of neat. I mean, it's what I grew up with. I'm comfortable with that. On the other hand, we have to think about what it means. I'm a huge gamer. I like games, I live games, I breathe games all the time, I talk about them constantly. But we should think about what these are. We should look at what it means to view the world this way. Because I want to be playing Pac-Man and not be played by him. Unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined medium is a scary thought. So, your homework assignment tonight is to go home and find a game and play it and see how it makes you think. Because I'm betting, because we all grew up with games, they're all bog familiar, you probably haven't thought too much about how they teach you and what they teach you, and why they teach you. And I'm guessing that when you go home, all of you, tonight, and pull out that old twister mat, you'll be looking at it differently. Thank you.